The word of God is alive and powerful, sharper than any two-edged sword, piercing even to the dividing asunder of the soul and the spirit and of the joints and the marrow, and is a critic of thoughts and intents of the heart. All scripture is God-breathed and is profitable for doctrine, for reproof, for correction, for instruction in righteousness, that the man of God might be mature, thoroughly furnished unto all good works. Study to show yourself approved unto God, a workman that does not need to be ashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth. Open the word of truth this morning to Mark chapter 14, where we are ready to continue with verse 32. All right, as I was watching TV the other night, I ran across a pretty important quote, I think. This guy's not a believer even, but he's figured certain things out. It's a guy named Ray Kurzweil. Human beings actually reorganize their frontal cortex as they pursue mastery over different skills. For instance, a musician redesigns his or her brain by means of constant study, practice, and performance. The same thing applies to the mathematician, carpenter, and pole dancer. The brain is physically changed over time by activity and learning. This means we have direct influence and control over how our minds operate. This means we actually mold our perception of the world by the way we mold our brains. And since most of us have moldy brains, we are here to reprogram them. That is the purpose of Bible class. It is to expose the believer to the systematic, organized study of sound doctrine so that he can take the Word of God, form it into his brain, start thinking about it, roll it over in his head, and this actually changes the way people think and the way they look at things. And over the years, if doctrine does not alter your perceptions of this world and what all is involved in God's plan, then doctrine is not working. But the problem would not then be with sound doctrine. The problem would be some other breakdown in the gap system. So we recognize God has provided a system. He has provided an environment, the local church. He has provided an instructor, the pastor teacher. He has provided a textbook, the Bible. And so therefore we have to avail ourselves of the issues of the truth as long as we can and as much as we can. Because this actually is going forward, mold the way you think in terms of how you are going to approach life. And failure to approach life properly can result in catastrophic results. So therefore, that is why we are here. It is now time to make sure you are in fellowship, to rebound if necessary. Every believer is either in or out of fellowship at any given point in time. And if you are out, now is the time to confess any sin you may have dealt with before God, and He will cleanse you from all unrighteousness. And beyond all that, it's to make sure you have everything you need before you so you're not distracting to other believers, recognizing that other people have the right to concentrate apart from any distractions and these types of things. We want to provide an environment where everyone can learn to the maximum. So it's time to make the adjustments we need to and prepare ourselves in the usual fashion. Let us pray. Well, Heavenly Father, we thank you for this local church. We thank you for the individual positive believers that you have assembled here, recognizing that ultimately our goal is to glorify you in time and grow as far as we can spiritually, ultimately laying a hold of the greatest rewards that you have for those that diligently seek you. We recognize that your grace has taken all things into account, that from eternity past you knew every detail of the future, and that you have made every provision so that believers can go as far as they can under their positive volition. We thank you for this great grace and pray as we approach your word this morning that God the Holy Spirit will continue to guide us in all the truth, for we ask it in Christ's name. Amen. All right, we are here moving on now to the next little section here, the next step in the drama that is unfolding, this step being the relocation to Gethsemane. They have been in the upper room probably for a couple or 3 hours and are making their way, the group minus Judas at any rate, making their way out of Jerusalem. We don't know where they were specifically in the city, but making their way out of Jerusalem and across the Kidron Valley and beginning the ascent up the Mount of Olives. Now, the problem is, we don't really know where Gethsemane is. But we can surmise that it's fairly simply, it's got to be on the western side of the Mount of Olives, Had they gone as far as Bethany, then that would have been on the complete other side. So we know they didn't go that far. But apparently this was a place, as we will find, that Jesus had used over the course of his ministry of some 3.5 years. It doesn't appear, as far as we can tell at least, it's not mentioned, that they went there at all during the last week except for this night. But Judas was familiar with the place, and apparently Jesus had used it on other occasions because of its privacy to get alone with the disciples, particularly. And really, when Mark talks about the disciples, while there may be other disciples involved, there are not this night. There's no indication there are anything with him other than the 11. He's most likely focusing on the apostles. He doesn't call them really apostles after he tells you about them in Mark there, chapter 3 or 4 or wherever it was, where he appointed these people as apostles. And I think it was actually later than that even. Maybe it was Mark 6. He summoned the 12 and sends them out. But earlier than that, he had appointed these men, 12 of them specifically, out of the group of disciples as apostles. That was chapter 3. So when he talks about the disciples, no more in view here, it doesn't seem, than just the 11. And as they travel across the Kidron Valley under the cover of darkness, and all this is done under the cover of darkness, but Jesus knows that at this point, darkness is no longer going to be a protection. He's aware of how this is going to unfold. He knows that his time is now very limited, and he is facing, although we didn't get it so much from Mark, when he talks about being betrayed, this really impacts him. Just as we saw when Mary made that offering there of the oil that she poured on him, it had an impact on him emotionally and doctrinally. He reacted to it. Well, this test is one that you're going to react to. The death test is one that will scare the bejesus out of about anybody. When you come face to face with death, you're going to realize it's a scary proposition. And the fact is, we have never known anything but life. And of course, neither had Jesus. But for him, this is a double-edged sword. It not only is going to involve great physical suffering and his physical death, it is going to involve great spiritual suffering and separation from his Father for the first time in his life. And the issue of spiritual death is the transcendent issue here. It is what it really he focuses on, because the fact is he is literally giving up his life. And not his physical life as we see, because he remains alive on the cross even after he has borne sins and died spiritually. So that physical life did not end until he chose it to. He is the only person in the world, in his deity, who had the right to check his humanity out. We don't have the right to do that. Suicide is not an option for the adjusted believer. So as they come out of the city, they make their way towards Gethsemane, and in verse 32, they arrive there. They came to a place named Gethsemane, and he said to his disciples, and is kai, not translated here, they came is erkomai, the simple verb to come. Into, which means they entered fully into it, whatever this was, directional preposition, ice, with the word chorion, C-H-O-R-I-O-N. Chorion's used 10 times, and it just means a tract or a piece of land. It's not very specific, so they translate it here with the sort of the generic term place, which is fine. A place which, relative pronoun host, the name of it, the name, to anima, the word for name, O-N-O-M-A, the designation, Gethsemane. Looks like that in the Greek. Two times, literally the word means oil press. Again, it's a name of a field or a plot of land on the Mount of Olives, and we would presume it's going to be on the west side. There's no indication that they crossed over it. And he said to the disciples, and as Kai, he says literally an historic present here, designed to bring you into the moment. He says to the disciples, sit here until I have prayed. He says, is lego, the simple verb to say, to the disciples, mathetes, students, learners, disciples, of him, his disciples, genitive of autos, sit here, aorist active imperative. This is a command of kathizo. K-A-T-H-I-Z-O. And that word just means exactly that, to sit down. Sit down here, adverb of place, hoda. And until, or as long as, or while, I might pray. And of course, what is contingent here is the time of prayer. Not whether he's going to pray or not, but the length of time he's going to pray. So this conjunction here, heos, means until, or as long as, I might pray as prosukomai. This is easily the most common verb, prosukomai. The most common verb for prayer is this, means to make a petition to a deity, here, of course, to God. It's used in other contexts, of course, for praying to false gods. Stay here, sit here, until I have prayed. And he took with him Peter, James, and John, which indicates, well, you should be able to do the math, he left eight of them somewhere around the entrance to this place. We don't know whether this place was walled. We don't know whether it was grown over or what it was exactly. There were certainly probably people living on this side of the Mount of Olives. But we don't really know if this was somebody's yard or just an abandoned place. This was not the time of the year, though, for the olive harvest, which would have come later in the year, August, September, October, in there. So this place would have been deserted at that time. So he leaves eight of them behind, and he takes with him Peter, James, and John. And as Kai, he takes, paralambano is the verb, again, a present indicative, P-A-R-A-L-A-M-B-A-N-O. To take or receive alongside, literally. The Peter, ho Petros, and James, Iakobos, and John, Ioannes. Their names there. With him. Preposition meta, used to denote accompaniment. With him, the autos here, the pronoun Jesus. He took with, and they've reversed the word order here. I don't have any idea but why they did that. But he took Peter, James, and John with him and began to be very distressed and troubled. And is kai, arco is the verb here, and this verb means to commence something or to begin it. A-R-C-H-O. He began to be, as they translate it, very distressed, is ek thambeo. E-K-T-H-A-M-B-E-O. And these are complementary infinitives. Arco is a verb, one of those verbs that takes a complementary infinitive in some cases to complete its thought. You begin to do something. And the infinitive here is used for that. Only four times this one's used in Mark. It means to be alarmed, frightened, troubled, or disturbed. And troubled. And is kai here, and then ade maneo is the verb. A-D-E-M-O-N-E-O. Only used three times here. The word means, it's generally translated distressed or bewildered. It actually comes from the word demos, the root, which means people or kinsmen. And then the alpha prefix negates it. It means to be without people, to be without your people, i.e. to be alone. When one it recognizes that they are completely alone in a situation, I mean, it's overwhelming. It can be. Doesn't mean it has to be, but it certainly can be. And he said to them, and Kai, he says, again, all of these are sort of emphatic presence to bring you sort of, again, into the moment is the idea of it. He says to them, my soul is deeply grieved to the point of death. Remain here and keep watch. He says to them, altas here must be limited to the three since they've left the other eight behind. You actually have the accusative here. It's not an accusative. It's a nominative, sorry. A nominative feminine singular here of perilupos. I misparsed that. P-E-R-I-L-U-P-O-S. This comes from the verb lupeo. Literally, the idea of peri means to be encircled or surrounded by something. So here's Jesus, and he's surrounded by sorrow. This is the sort of spatial orientation of the word. Five times, literally to be surrounded by lupe, to be very sad, we would probably translate it deeply depressed. My soul is deeply depressed. Is the present indicative of aini, the to be verb, and then the noun suke for soul. P.S. We get our word like psyche, psychology, all that comes from this root. The soul. Which is interesting because psychology doesn't always get to the soul. And this is part of the problem with our mental health issues in this world, is they don't acknowledge the immaterial part of man, the soul. I mean, some Christian probably people do. But if one does not recognize what you're dealing with, it's going to be very difficult to deal with it. So here you have Jesus, my soul, pronoun ego here. My soul is deeply depressed. Then you have again the same conjunction, heos, up to or as far as, used with a genitive to denote a limit, to the point of death, athanatos. Now, I'm going to presume that Jesus is not exaggerating. He's not being maudlin. He's not being over the top with all of this. This is all true. This is as specific as it gets. My soul is deeply depressed to the point of dying, to the point of death. Remain here. Abide. This is actually our word for abide, minnow. It's the same verb. It means to abide, to remain, to stay in a place. Remain here. Again, it's an aorist active imperative. Stay here, hoda, again, adverb, in this place, and keep watch. Gregoreo is our verb. Gregoreo. This word literally means to stay awake, to keep watchful, to be alert. And, of course, now, by this time, we are probably after midnight. Could be as late as 1. We don't know yet exactly for sure what time it is. It's very late in the evening, though. It's probably been a long day, although not much is recorded about that last day, Thursday, and maybe not too much went on. We really don't know. But he tells them, stay here and watch. Stay awake with me. I need some support here. And this is one of the few times, if ever, that he's actually asked them for support. Well, one, although many interpreters have asserted the fact that one of the requirements of the Passover was to spend the night in Jerusalem, again, I hate to point out the obvious, this is not Passover night. This is Thursday. This is not Friday. So therefore that, and I don't know how many, I bet you half the interpreters bring that up. And I'm thinking, it's not Passover. What difference does it make what the rules were for Passover? Clearly, it's not Passover. It's Thursday, and Jesus has been going out of the city every night. And so he continues to do the same thing, in a sense. I mean, they leave the city much later than they ever had. I mean, they were usually leaving by sundown, obviously, to get back to Bethany. So that requirement was not why Jesus went to the Mount of Olives. And I'm just stunned at the amount of interpreters that say, well, this is it. Well, no, it's not it. There's no requirement for them to stay in the city, not on this night. Two, in fact, there is some indication that this trip to the Mount of Olives was not perceived to be markedly different than the trip Jesus had made every night that week. When you look in Luke's account, Luke 22:39, he acknowledges that this had been Jesus' way of doing this all week. And he came out, i.e. came out of the city, and proceeded, as was his custom, to the Mount of Olives. And the disciples also followed him. And this is not unusual. Now, they stop at the place, and he said to them, and they stop at Gethsemane, but there's no indication they had been stopping there that evening, or before that evening. I mean, it just appears, I mean, all we're told in Mark was they went back to Bethany every night. He'd leave the city and go back out of the town and go to Bethany. Three, the word Gethsemane literally translates as oil press and referred to an area that was located within one of the many olive groves of the area. Outside of the Bible, however, the name's not attested, so you're not going to find any extra biblical information on this place at all. And guess why it was called the Mount of Olives? A lot of olive trees. A lot of olive farms, a lot of people growing olives. They were, and we know certainly, at least at some point, we don't know exactly where it was. But even wild olive trees would spring up. You know, there was one, a lone olive tree. We remember seeing that, the fig tree was a lone fig tree by the side of the road. So this place is pretty fertile and it grows pretty well. And it's predominantly olives as you get, and that's why it's named that. Before only Matthew and Mark named the actual garden, which would allow any interested individual to investigate Mark's account. Luke simply calls it the place, and we just saw that, while John describes it only as a garden. That's all he says about it. They went into a garden with no more specificity than that. He went with his disciples over the ravine of the Kidron, that valley there, as you go down off the Mount of Olives, you go down through a valley and then back up as you're going into Jerusalem. And this was, again, the very same thing he had done every night, so I don't think they thought anything was all that. I think they figured they'd end up back in Bethany that night. I think that's what the disciples probably thought. But again, they are out of it in terms of believing what's actually going to happen here. Well, five, the Greek term translated as place is the diminutive chorion, which first meant a limited geographical area that was around a city. And close to it politically, closely related to it rather, politically and economically. Well, certainly this would qualify. Acts 28:7 is a place where this is used and is pretty plain. This would qualify as being around the environs of Jerusalem. The Mount of Olives certainly was very much associated with Jerusalem. You could sit on the Mount of Olives and look over the city. As a matter of fact, if any of you want to see some pictures, Seamus has got quite a few of them from his trip there. And one of the things you see was, you know, and now it's it, much, a whole lot of the western side of the Mount of Olives is filled up with tombs, external tombs there, where because they all believe this is where Messiah is going to return, and that's where they want to be when they get resurrected. Well, if they're believers, they'll get resurrected. If not, too bad. But you can see literally kind of you're looking down sort of at some level into the city. You can see over the city walls and all of that, that were there at that time anyway. Well, Acts 28:7. Now, in the neighborhood of that place, there were lands belonging to the leading man of the island named Publius, who welcomed us and entertained us courteously for 3 days. And that's here in the neighborhood or in the vicinity of that place, there were these lands. This guy had sort of outside of his, we might say, his proper property, he had some extra holdings. So, but they were associated with him, and everybody knew that. Six, it was also used to refer to a landed piece of property, a field or area that was a part of a larger estate. And it would seem that the term implies an area of ground without any housing. There doesn't seem to be any indication that this is somebody's homestead or anything like that, or that somebody's living on the property. And there is a possibility that there was someone living nearby, but we don't know. And the only reason we say that is if you look ahead in chapter 14, in verse 51, we get this strange verse that is not explained anywhere about this young man was following him, wearing nothing but a piece of linen over his naked body. And they seized him, and he pulled free of the linen sheet and escaped. Some have suggested, well, maybe this was somebody who lived in that vicinity who came out to investigate what was happening. You've got a couple of options of what could be going on here, and that certainly is one of them. But there's not enough information here provided about that to say for certain, oh, well, this was somebody following them out of the city, this was somebody who came out because of the commotion or whatever it was. Well, seven, there's no reason, real reason, to doubt the tradition that this garden was located on the western slope of the Mount of Olives, just east of Jerusalem across the Kidron Valley. And eight, however, the Bible does not actually provide the location of Gethsemane, so any identification of this place is more a matter of tradition than biblical fact. And let's face it, as you probably know, Jerusalem is a bit of a tourist destination. It's a place where people like to go, particularly believers. And so they will have these things. They'll say, well, this is where such and such happened. Well, they may not know. They may not even be correct. But if they can sell it to the tourists, it's fine. You know? So in some cases, there's just still no real indication that I can find at all that would really identify where this is at on the Mount of Olives. And of course, much of this, with the destruction of Israel and the dissemination of the nation after, they got dispersed under the Romans, lots of this areas were damaged and tore up and, decimated. The Romans didn't really leave, as Jesus had predicted, one stone on top of another. They leveled the place. They raised it to the ground. And it was not uncommon during that time, and certainly in the first century, for invading armies and that sort of thing to also trash the land. In some cases, they would sow salt in it, so nothing would grow. They didn't obviously do that everywhere, but that was one of the things they would do. So this place, wherever it was, has probably long since been destroyed. We don't know where it's at. But if you go there, somebody may say, well, we can take you there. Well, they probably can't. 9, the fact that John describes Jesus and the apostles entering into it may mean that it was a walled or enclosed area. It certainly, the directional preposition ice here means fully into it. So whatever the area was, it was some particular little area. Again, whether it was walled off with hedges or bricks or whatever else, stones, we don't really know. But what we do know is that they went into it. Wherever this area was, they went directly into it and did not stay, say, on the fringes of it. Although the 8 were left towards the outside of it, whatever the area was. Well, 11, since it was springtime and the normal olive harvest occurred in September, October, the place would be deserted, which was the type of place Jesus sought as he entered the final stretch of his coming ordeal. Shouldn't be an apostrophe there, though. 12, after they entered the garden, Matthew and Mark indicate that Jesus instructed 8 of the apostles to sit down and wait while he moved some distance away to pray. Matthew 26:36. And then Jesus came with them to a place called Gethsemane, and he said to his disciples, "Sit here while I go over there and pray." And just as Mark's account records, he took with him Peter and the 2 sons of Zebedee, although Mark says James and John, which we knew were the sons of Zebedee. And he began to be grieved and distressed. The accounts here are amazingly similar. 13, Luke records the fact that Jesus instructed the 8 to pray specifically for themselves, that they would not enter into temptation. Now, they don't know what the temptation is, and Jesus isn't any more specific than that at this point. But the temptation is going to be to run. It's what they're going to find out. They're going to get up to this and they're going to find out the temptation is going to be to flee. And then even beyond that, the temptation to completely disassociate themselves from Jesus, to deny him. So Luke says that here, as he said to them, they arrived at the place, "Pray that you may not enter into temptation." And Luke doesn't record that he separated the group, where you'd get that from, say, Matthew and Mark, that the group was broken up into 2 groups. Well, 14, the temptation would come in the form of a satanic attack in which they would be attempted to deny Jesus. This was something that had already happened to Judas and which was about to happen to Peter. Luke 22:31-32, where, again, we see Simon, Simon. And the repetition of the name is designed to be emphatic here to get Peter's attention. "Look, Satan has demanded permission to sift you like wheat." And in wheat, the way it was sifted, to separate the wheat from the chaff, you beat it. Well, typically was what they did. They would beat it, and the wheat and the chaff would separate. And then, of course, the chaff was lighter, and they would throw it up into the air. The wheat was heavier, and the chaff would kind of blow in the wind. And so, as he tells Peter, he doesn't, when he says sift you like wheat, that may not come across to us, but I mean, Satan's going to put a beat down on him. And Peter needs it. He needs a beat down put on him at this point. And he's going to get one. He's going to get a good one. "But I have prayed for you, that your faith may not fail. And you, when once you have turned again, strengthen your brothers. And of course, Peter argued with him. What a shock. Couldn't see that one coming. Not at this late date. Well, 15, on the other occasions in Mark, when he dealt with the matter of Jesus praying, it is clear that Jesus did not view prayer primarily, at least primarily, as a public matter. Now, it's not to say he never prayed in public. He did. We know, for instance, when he fed the 5,000, it says he looked towards heaven and thanked God for the food. And that's fine for a public prayer, but Jesus did most of his praying alone. We saw when he, after the feeding of the 5,000, when they wanted to make him king, and he went off to the mountain, and he must have spent 5, 6, 7 hours up there praying. And that was the time he ended up walking across the water to catch up with them on the Sea of Galilee. So 16, in fact, on previous occasions when Jesus desired to pray, he took great care to get away from everyone, even from his closest disciples. And Mark doesn't record a lot of these times, but the two he does record make it pretty plain that Jesus really viewed prayer as a pretty much a private matter, as it should be. And he tells, when he's talking to them about prayer, he tells them, when you pray, go into your closet, i.e. close the door and get away from everybody, so you can have full concentration on this. Now again, that's not to say you can't pray at other times. You can pray while you're driving, you can pray if things allow it. You don't want to be too distracted, obviously, while you're driving. But the fact is, you can pray over your meals, you can pray out in public, but generally speaking, it's viewed as a private thing between you and God. 1:35, and early in the morning, while it was still dark, Jesus got up, left the house, and went away to a secluded place and was praying there. And, of course, then they go out and they find him. But this is up around Capernaum, so this isn't even in the same area. But he would withdraw from people. He would find these places that were out of the way. And then also in Mark 6:46. And again, this is following the feeding of the 5,000. And Mark doesn't record all of the sort of backstory here where the crowds decided they're going to force Jesus to be king right now, whether he wants to or not. They're going to have a coronation, a coup, as it were. And just like they're having in Egypt, I suppose. This sounds like a fun place to visit. He doesn't record all this, but he makes Jesus. What we do here in verse 45 is that he makes the disciples get in the boat. And so there's some indication to me, and again, knowing the nature of the disciples, it would not shock me if they were not involved in all of this. I really think they were, and Jesus got them away from the crowd because the crowd had, what happens, people get caught up in these crowds and mobs, and they begin to think like the mob thinks. Well, that was no good in this case. So he sends them away, and while he himself was sending the crowd away. And after bidding them farewell, he went up to the mountain to pray. Now here it's still daytime. And then we find out later, when it was evening, the boat was on the middle of the sea, and he was still alone on the land. And then we find out in verse 48, it was at about the fourth watch of the night. The night was divided into four watches, from 6 to 9, 9 to 12, 12 to 3, and 3 to 6 in the morning. And so the fourth watch places us at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning when this all happened. And it was still daylight when Jesus sent the people away, say at 6 that evening. So the indication is he spent, maybe as much as 8, 9 hours up there praying. So obviously he knew that something was going on and had to deal with all of this. And if he needs to pray that much as the Son of God, well, I think the lesson is obvious for us. He's got a lot more on the ball than we had. Sinless and all makes it, somewhat better. But he had to pray a lot. And 17, as Jesus has done on other occasions, he leaves the main body of the disciples alone and takes his inner circle of Peter, James, and John with him. Now, we'd seen him do that when he was approached by this Jairus, the synagogue leader, back in 5:37. And this was where this woman gets healed as well. But and he allowed no one to accompany him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. So he told he basically told all the crowds and the other disciples, stay back here where they were. And Jesus took his three, and then, of course, Jairus and whoever was with him back to Jairus' house, where again, the girl was in a coma. She was not dead. She was in a coma, a deep coma. Not maybe there's no other kind. Although Will has often had mild comas, you know, but he sees all this and he tells them she's not dead. And they all start laughing because they think he's nuts because they've already pronounced her dead. Well, she wasn't dead, but he raised her up. So he took these three with him. And also we saw it again on the Mount of Transfiguration in Mark 9:2. He separates these three from the other group. 6 days later, Jesus took with him Peter, James, and John and brought them up to a high mountain by themselves. And as we find out, when they're sitting there on the Mount of Olives, it's Peter, James, and John. And of course, in chapter 13, and Andrew joins them on this particular occasion. But again, it was just sort of the inner circle. And Jesus had, again, this demonstrates, number one, he didn't treat all the apostles even the same. And it wasn't, of course, that Jesus is a respecter of person or that he has other problems. He's obviously not any of the things that we would expect or that people might think, well, why is he playing favorites here? It's that for whatever reason, these three were the ones he dealt with the most. And that's his call. I mean, even amongst the group of the disciples. So they tended to get these sort of private audiences and in some cases were privy to things that the others were just not privy to. And there has to be a reason for all that. Well, 18 Matthew records the additional fact that Jesus was going to withdraw a small distance from them. And Luke indicates that the distance was about a stone's throw. Matthew 26:39, where actually he just says he went a little ways beyond them and fell on his face and prayed. And in Luke, he's a little more specific in Luke 22:41 when he talks about the distance he separates himself from Peter, James, and John. He withdrew from them about a stone's throw, and he knelt down and he began to pray. And at first he kneels, and then later what happens is he will fall on his face. He kind of goes down in stages. It takes some time. It doesn't just happen all at once. He didn't just plop down and there it was. This took some time, and that'll be brought out later in Mark's account. Well, 19, when the conjunction heos, until, is used with a subjunctive as it is here, it indicates a future contingency from the time of the main verb. In other words, the length of time they were to remain in that spot was contingent upon the amount of time Jesus prayed. You stay here until I'm done. Now, I'm not, obviously he didn't tell them how long you're going to be, but it appears that he prayed for about the space of an hour. We don't have clock on this, and nobody was keeping time out there. So, and at that time of night, you would not have, other than just a guess as to what time it was, as it were. So 20, following his instructions to the other eight, Jesus Christ takes Peter, James, and John with him and begins manifesting some of the overt signs of the spiritual stress under which he was laboring. 21, the use of the verb arco, to begin or start something, indicates that the pressures Jesus was facing had now intensified to the point that there was visible evidence of what was going on in his soul. And sometimes when people are under intense pressure, you cannot keep it off of your face. It manifests itself. I mean, it shows itself. For some people, this is why they're not good poker players. They can't keep their emotions off their face. And that will always get you beat. Well, it's a matter of controlling this at some level, and he has to deal with it. I mean, he can't just... What happens if Jesus just completely cracks here and goes to pieces and falls apart and all of that? Well, then it'd all be over with. But that doesn't happen. He stays on top of this no matter how difficult it was. Well, 22, the first thing Jesus began to manifest is described by the verb ekthambeo. This family of words is used only seven times and only by Mark. So this family of words is unique to his gospel. The verb describes the response of one that is amazed, astonished, or overwhelmed by various circumstances. And up to this point in the ministry of Jesus Christ, this family of words is only used of the reaction of others to Jesus, to his actions or teachings. We saw it back in the at the very beginning of the gospel, Mark 1:27. But this word's only been used of other people responding to him. Mark 1:27, they were all amazed. And that's how it's generally translated, so that they debated among themselves. What is this? A new teaching with authority? He commands even the unclean spirits and they obey him? Well, I mean, this was a big deal when he cast this demon out of this guy in the midst of the synagogue. I mean, there were a bunch of people there to worship, and yet this demon-possessed guy was sitting there and nobody apparently knew. So this tells you how good the demons are at hiding themselves and how well they can fool people. Judas is Satan-possessed by this point, and I don't think any of the apostles picked up on it at all. And this guy is sitting there in the midst, we might say, of the church service, and he's demon-possessed. And so, of course, there's a conflict that comes to the surface. Also, chapter 9, verse 15. And this is in that situation where he comes down from the Mount of Transfiguration. And the disciples, the other disciples outside of Peter, James, and John, had had this failure of trying to cast out this demon. They weren't able to do it. And they had been able to do it up to this point. And immediately, when the entire crowd saw him, they were amazed. And began running up to greet him. And then also 10, we see it twice in chapter 10, 24 and 32. And this is where Jesus essentially runs off the rich young ruler, will not cater to him, and does not lower the standards for any of discipleship. Because if he was going to be a disciple of Jesus, Jesus knows it means you've got to sell out. You've got to go all in on this deal. And he wasn't willing to. And so he goes away, and of course the disciples, I think, are sitting there thinking, wow, this would be a great addition to our group. This guy's got a lot of money, he's popular, he's good looking, he's got all these things going for him, and Jesus here has run him off. And Jesus looks at the disciples and says, look, how hard will it be for those who are wealthy to enter the kingdom of God? And the disciples were amazed at his words. Because fully, really, the doctrine was that day, if you were wealthy, it means God's for you, and obviously you got a spot in the kingdom. And the physical prosperity, people still believe this, the physical prosperity proves that somehow God's for you. And as long as I'm doing okay physically, it means God's blessing me. Well, it may mean that. We're not saying it can't mean that. But there are some horribly evil people in this world that make a lot of money and have a lot of money. And so money is no sign of orientation to God. And the disciples just bought into the stuff that their contemporaries bought into. And that was the thinking that the rich Jew really must be favored by God. And then Jesus comes along and says, no, that's not the case. And so they're shocked. I mean, you could even translate it here. The disciples were shocked at his words because they couldn't believe this. And then in verse 32, and they were going on the road up to Jerusalem. And Jesus was walking on ahead of them. And they were amazed, and those who followed were fearful. So you get two distinct emotional responses here. Talked about it. I think the first one is attributed to the disciples themselves. And the rest are the group that are following them. But what's astonishing to them is that he's just told them, you know, I'm going to die. He'd been telling this. You know, this was the third time, in fact, on this road up there to Jerusalem. He tells them this. He'd been telling this, I'm going to Jerusalem, there's going to be this horrible conflict, they're going to betray me, turn me over and kill me, and here he is marching into it as though he's not afraid of this at all. Well, this is shocking to people, that he would approach this in this way. And this is one of the things we see, until we get to Gethsemane, we see no evidence that Jesus was even hardly concerned about this. Now, he had to be. I mean, if you knew you were dying in 6 weeks, 8 weeks, you know, they told you. And it's not like, you know, he got a diagnosis of cancer or something where, well, they could be wrong. You never know. People have lived years after their diagnosis and supposed death. But Jesus knows precisely when he's going to die. He knows exactly when this is going to happen. And so it's always looming over him. And of course, the last 6-8 months of the ministry, he's been emphasizing this to almost the exclusion of everything else. This has been really in the forefront. That we're going to Jerusalem and it's not going to go well. And then, of course, when they get to Jerusalem and he's riding in on that donkey and the city's going nuts, the disciples are probably thinking, I guess he was wrong. Now, that's on Monday. Monday, they're thinking, probably feeling pretty good about it. And then he goes in there Tuesday and ticks them off again in the temple and gets the religious leaders all riled up. And then Wednesday is a day of complete and utter conflict from probably beginning to end pretty much. And of course, it was during that day that Judas snuck off and did his deal, made his arrangements. And of course, when it says they were glad when Judas came, I mean, that's an understatement. I mean, they'd been wanting to kill this guy for at least 3 years and couldn't find a way to do it, couldn't seem to arrest him no matter what they did. And he just seemed to escape from them at every turn. So they're very happy about all of this. But when they come in Monday, they're probably feeling pretty good about it. I mean, he's getting a hero's welcome into Jerusalem. And again, by Friday, well, you're going to find out some of those same people that were cheering him into the city are going to be calling for his blood. So that's the nature of the crowds. They're fickle. But again, as we've seen and I pointed out, that Greek term oklos, the term for crowds, really has a sort of unfavorable connotation to it. That the crowds are not viewed as anything other than fickle and untrustworthy. That's just the nature of crowds. And see, people read this all wrong. They think the more people you got, the better off you are. But Jesus wasn't fooled by all of this. His quote, popularity, he didn't get suckered into this. He didn't say, oh, well, the ministry's really going great. Look at all these people. Which is what the disciples probably thought. The ministry's going great. Look at all these people. And Jesus is thinking, yeah, well, don't worry. A little bit of teaching, a little bit of sound teaching. Eat my flesh and drink my blood, and he'll run off a whole bunch of them. Little things they don't want to hear. Well, 25 here, the term is used for the overwhelming reality that he was now facing the specter of death. And it is very much the normal human reaction to the matter of physical death. I've heard people tell me, I've even had believers tell me, oh, well, I'm not afraid to die. Yeah, but you haven't been close to death yet, have you? And the person told me, no. Okay, well, when you get close to death, let me warn you, it's scary. It's freaky. Because again, we've never known anything but life. Now, we recognize death is also, as David calls it in the 23rd Psalm there, the shadow of death. And death itself cannot ultimately do us in. But, again, when your soul starts to leave your body, it's a freaky thing. And people are unprepared for that. Well, clearly here it has a profound impact on Jesus when he's facing it. And if I'm going to presume that he was normal. And that this is the normal reaction of a normal person. That there's nothing unusual here to me. I mean, obviously, the thing that would be only unusual is that he knows he's facing spiritual death, where we would only be facing physical death. We wouldn't be thinking, oh, I'm going to be separated from God, essentially going to hell. We wouldn't think that. Well, 26, the parallel in Matthew uses the Greek verb lupeo, which denotes the severe emotional distress that comes from sadness, grief, and even depression. Again, the language very similar to the language in Mark. 27, thus, it is not too much to say that Jesus Christ was overwhelmed with the prospect of what he would face in the next few hours and naturally recoiled from the idea of the brutality that would be involved in his own crucifixion. Every one of these men had seen a crucifixion. The Romans were not. See, the Romans believed capital punishment was a deterrent. And they really believed it. So they would broadcast their capital executions as far and wide as they could. When they crucified somebody, they didn't take them out by the garbage dump and set them up. They took them to the main roads, the crossroads where people traveled, and this is what happens to those who violate. And very often they would hang the charge on the deal to see what. This is what happens to thieves. This is what happens to murderers. This is what happens to insurrectionists. And so, and we see the same thing. Well, we're going to see it. We don't see it here yet, but we're going to see that when they put Jesus on the cross, they put this placard above him to tell you what the charge was. His charge was, he said he was the king of the Jews. That's the charge against him. They didn't put up there any other charge. But they, when the Romans did this, they made sure that everybody knew it. And so everybody had seen this. And they knew what a crucifixion was. And it's a horrible, it's probably the most god-awful way to die that you can imagine. It can linger. People could linger for days, even a week sometimes. And they would give them liquid, because obviously you can only survive so long. You can go about 3 days without water. You can last longer than that without food. Jesus fasted for 40 days, so we know that you can last quite a while without food. But with all the stress and all the crucifixion and all that, I mean, it's a trauma that's just almost mind-boggling. That people, and they've seen all this. So when he sees that, I mean, he's seen all this. But again, there's more to this. When we look at the brutality of it, if you want to see that movie, The Passion of the Christ, it shows the brutality of it, but it doesn't show the spiritual side of it. And so only a believer really gets what's going on the unseen side of this. But Jesus knew as well. Well, 28, it is coupled in both Matthew and Mark with the verb a de maneo. Which is used only three times. There is still significant disagreement over the derivation, but Thayer suggests that it literally means not at home. Again, not with the idea of not with your people, not with your family, not with those around you that you surround yourself with for comfort, encouragement, support, and all of that. And everybody should have a support system of some sort. This is why we're never meant to be lost to ourselves. This is why no believer is an island. You're a part of a body. And the body has to pull together and work together, or it won't work at all. Well, 29, thus the idea would be of one of being uncomfortable because he was out of his element. Moulton and Milligan suggest that it is the opposite of one that is prudent or knowledgeable. And they give the sense of being bewildered. But again, the two senses may overlap somewhat. When you're out of your element and something begins to go wrong, how do you feel? You feel bewildered. You feel overwhelmed. You're not prepared for this. And there was no way to be prepared for what he was facing. I mean, there's just no way that one could psych themselves up to say, well, okay, this is no big deal. Because it is a big deal. It's the biggest deal that ever happened, in fact. Well, 30, in either case, the term, it is a strong term, perhaps the strongest term for bewilderment, anxiety, or confusion that is used in the New Testament. And 31, thus Jesus began to experience the emotional state of one that was overwhelmed with sadness, sorrow, or grief. And again, it is difficult to imagine the anxiety of a man. You think I've had panic attacks before. I don't have them much anymore. I haven't had one in a while, but I've had them. So people say, well, panic attacks, what are they? Well, they're not fun, let me just tell you. You'll just have this overwhelming sense of doom that will permeate everything you're thinking. And for me, it was always, I'm just going to die. I think I'm just going to die. And again, when you come up the idea you're going to die, you can start freaking yourself out. Well, now Jesus is not freaking himself out. Well, that's one thing we can say he's not bringing to this. But again, it's hard to imagine the anxiety of a man that knew he would be condemned to crucifixion in just a matter of hours. Isaiah 53:3 talks about this in that prophetic passage. And very much now, of course, the Isaiah 53 passage is the critical Old Testament passage on the suffering servant. And this is very much what we're into now in Mark's account. He's been shown throughout the account as the servant of God. But now he's becoming the suffering servant, the one who's going to provide redemption. Isaiah 53:3, he was despised and forsaken of men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, and like one from whom men hid their face. He was despised and we did not esteem him. We didn't get it. We didn't know what he was going through. We couldn't. And the prophecy here comes true, to the T in the life of Christ. That he understood, he knows other things that these people don't know. For instance, he knows that most of the people he's going to die for will never believe. Now, again, it would be one thing. We've seen people in history at various times be willing to sacrifice their life in order to save some people. But generally speaking, number one, the person they're going to save very often is somebody who's thought highly of, or who has some reputation. It's not just, they're not going down to Skid Row to die for people. They're not going down, you know, to the homeless to die for them. But Jesus is taking all of these things into account. And so he's very much acquainted with the pain and the suffering in the world. He's seen it up close. He knows what these people are facing. He knows what his disciples are facing. He knows how fragile they actually are in spite of their bravado. They're giving you the male testosterone deal. I'm a man. I can handle all this. I won't deny you. Yeah. Guess what? Testosterone's only going to take you so far. And it won't get you through tests like this. And so he has seen people. He knows what they are. He knows how they suffer. He's dealt with taking the sufferings, curing these illnesses and these diseases, and casting out demons and freeing people from their burdens. So he understands burdens. He's been through it himself and very much understands the human condition. Well, 32, the fact that both strong terms are used to describe the same event is designed to convey the reality that Jesus was suffering emotionally at a level that was really beyond comprehension. The pressure on his soul in this hour, when the forces of darkness were prevailing, was crushing. Luke 22:53, we're going to see there that there's this medical condition that he goes through. That should actually be 22:43, not 53. And now an angel from heaven appeared to him, strengthening him. And we're not told how. We're not told what he did. We're not told, did he just talk to him? Did he just say, hey, you know this is why you were born? Remember all the prophecies? Well, I mean, what did he do? Was there some sort of physical strength given to him? We're not told. We're just told that an angel shows up. And being in agony, he was praying very fervently, and his sweat became like drops of blood falling upon the ground. And so, again, while we've had times in our lives where I'm sure every one of us has been under demonic attack. We deal with the forces of darkness. We better deal with them, because they're going to deal with you whether you like it or not. So you better know your armor. And again, the thinking, if this part up here is straight, you can withstand a whole lot of things. And Jesus is going to be a good example of this, because none of us are going to suffer to this level. None of us are going to face this kind of pressure and testing that he faces here. It's really beyond the pale. All right, well, our time is up. Let's go ahead and we'll stop there. Let's go ahead and take our normal 20-minute break, and we'll pick up here at about 5 after.